American. I'm not criticizing America. I'm criticizing those who use our country, our tax dollars, our sons, and now even our daughters to go fight these wars to make the world safe for the big oil cartels and ITT and Chase Manhattan and the big banks and investors in those countries.
Michael Parenti and the New World Order on this edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. Dr. Michael Parenti is the author of several books, including The Sword and the Dollar and Make Believe Media. He's been thinking a lot about the massive changes taking place in the world and what they mean for the United States of America. In our conversation, he first tells us what he thinks President Bush means when he talks about a new world order.
What he means is that there will no longer be a block of communist or socialist countries that can give assistance to national liberation movements and other kinds of struggles throughout the Third World. That all of that has crumbled, and now the United States will be able to control pretty much most of the world with a network, global network of 300 major bases and hundreds of minor bases, and therefore will be able to intervene throughout the world whenever any country tries to develop an independent economic course, one that moves away from global multinational corporatism. Panama, which decides it wants to pursue an independent policy on the Panama Canal and doesn't want to cooperate in a war against Nicaragua, and Iraq. It doesn't have to be communist or socialist. It can just be even a right-wing nationalist like Iraq. Saddam Hussein was a right-wing anti-communist nationalist. But he wanted a better break on the oil prices, and he wanted to use a larger portion of the oil earnings for the development of his own country. And he was taught a lesson, and it was a lesson that was delivered to all the countries in the region, which is that if you interfere with the privileges of the multinational corporations that own and control most of your labor, your land, your natural resources, and market them and such, and if you refuse to be a client state and cooperate fully in that way, then you will feel the full wrath and might of the United States.
So is the new world order, it's not our goal necessarily, it's just the situation is new.
The goal is the same as it's always been, it's just that the situation is new. National liberation movements no longer can get resources from other countries, from say, East Germany or the Soviet Union or whatever. And the new world order really resembles the old world order. It's what some of us call imperialism, which is when the dominant interests in a country control the land, labor, markets, capital, natural resources of other countries, and therefore control the political life and destiny of those countries.
In the New World Order, will there be a legitimate role for multilateral organizations like the United Nations?
Well, to the extent that U.S. and Western industrial capitalist power has become so dominant, the U.N. will pretty much fall in line. To some degree, there'll be nations in the UN which will try to take a Saddam Hussein view or would like to have their national autonomy preserved, so there may be times when they will vote against U.S. policy. But the UN is generally ignored and has been for the last 25 years by the U.S. leadership and by the U.S. media. When the U.S. kept losing votes in the UN by 110-2 on things like putting weapons in outer space and things like that, the media ignored it and nothing much was said, and the UN was not thought to be very important. When the UN could be brought around to stop, to put its imprimatur on an act of violence and an attack on Iraq, then the UN became prominent. So whether the UN plays a prominent role or gets attention or doesn't depends on whether it's useful in a tool for this overall policy. George Bush is amazingly, remarkably consistent. I don't believe he very often tells the truth, but he is remarkably consistent. When he says, people say he's inconsistent because against communist China he says, let's trade with them, let's be friends with them, we don't need a litmus test, we can't impose, they're moving in their own good time, in their own development. And but with communist Cuba, he says, they've got to have elections, they've got to have a free market, they've got to do this, they've got to do that, and they've got to make these changes before we'll lift the embargo. And people have said that's inconsistent. But it's not really, because in communist China, they've opened up the country. Their cheap labor markets are open up. They've opened up the country to multinational corporate investments on terms that are very favorable to the money-making corporations. And Cuba hasn't done that. So it's really not democracy he's pursuing. It's really making these countries safe client states for U.S. power, and especially U.S. economic power.
And you would say that's not only consistent with George Bush, but that's been consistent in U.S. foreign policy for
right.
How long?
That policy is not peculiar to George Bush. He just gave it a new name. But it's been going on ever since the U.S. emerged as a world power in 1898, when McKinley picked a fight with Spain, supposedly to liberate the poor Cubans from Spanish oppression. And the first battle and the first troops were sent to the Philippines, just to grab the Philippines and to grab Guam and grab a piece of Samoa and grab Puerto Rico and so forth. And McKinley said, in a few months we'd become a world power. As U.S. economic power grew, they had needed new markets. That, by the way, doesn't necessarily benefit the people of the United States to be sending troops to the Philippines or to Iraq and all that. We pay the hundreds of billions of dollars in tax bill to protect the profits of Exxon and Mobil and Gulf.
All of that seemed to work in a manner good for U.S. business when the U.S. was a leading economic power. But what happens when there are new economic powers like Germany or Japan? Do we compete with them, or do we ally ourselves with them in opening up new markets around the world?
Well, there may be competition between Japan and the U.S. One of the things that put a limit on competition between capitalist countries is the existence of a socialist world. Now that that socialist or communist world has dissolved, these competitions may become more marked and more outspoken. But the Japanese have no interest in a military confrontation with the U.S., and they wouldn't be able to sustain one, and they couldn't have the first time, and they should have never done it the first time. They knew there at least were elements, military elements in Japan, who knew they were going to lose the minute Pearl Harbor took place. So it's not going to be, there's not going to be a war that one can imagine, but there are going to be some very real conflicts probably.
So I guess what I'm asking is, in places like the Philippines or wherever, is it enough to say that we're going to keep those, or that U.S. foreign policy is supposed to keep those markets open for business? Is it enough to say that, or is it for U.S. business?
Well, it's for all of the
for above. All business.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, the U.S. most of the business is. Well, I mean, I think the U.S. controls about 14% of the world's business now. Japan has moved from 6 to 12%, and all the other countries control a lot of the other stuff. That's direct investment. Of course, indirect investment may be even more. But generally, when U.S. power goes in, it's to give preference to American companies. When the U.S., for instance, let's take the case of Iran back in the 1950s, when Mossadegh came into power and he nationalized the oil companies in Iran, the biggest one was British Petroleum. The Brits had been in Iran long before we got around to it. When he was overthrown by the CIA under the leadership of Kermit Roosevelt was then rewarded with a six-figure bonus, as I recall, and was made vice president of Gulf Oil Company. And the U.S. companies were rewarded. because the Shah of Iran, who was put in his place, took 40% of British Petroleum, previous British Petroleum holdings, and handed them over to the American companies. So the U.S. has squeezed out the British there. They squeeze out British sugar companies in Central America, often, you know, with American companies. And on the other hand, you may get things that are very multinational.
I was going to say, we had Robert Reich on the program before, and he talked about how there's really ceasing to be anything such as a U.S. company or a British company. There are merely multinational companies who move their businesses around to take advantage of the best benefits, tax, labor, resources, whatever. And so how would that play into this idea then, that it'd be multinational and not necessarily national?
Yeah, I hear that quite often. The truth is they're still national. The truth is General Motors is not a Japanese company. It's an American company. General Motors won't tell you that. General Motors wants you to believe just what you just quoted, that we really aren't American. We're in France. We're in Argentina. We're in Mexico. We're in South Korea. We are multinational. Sure, they would like to be above all nations and not subjected to the laws or rules of any nation. But the fact is, when one of their factories gets grabbed, they don't go to the Japanese Defense Force and the Japanese Foreign Ministry. They go to the U.S. State Department and complain and say, do something about this or other. So they are... There are American companies, and there are German companies, and there are Japanese and British and Dutch and Italian and French, and while they often may merge or, you know, have some mixing of capital, for the most part they're still nationally distinct. And that thing about there are no really national companies, they're all just so diffuse now, is really highly overstated.
Okay. Well, back to more specifically the New World Order.
And by the way, as much as we hear about the Japanese, most of the foreign investment in this country is not Japanese, it's British, and then I think Dutch. I think the Japanese are third or fourth. And the 10 largest companies in the world, most of them are still American. The largest corporation, industrial corporation, in the entire world is General Motors. And that's the same General Motors that was crying to the American public a couple of years ago and said we have to close down factories and lay off 25,000 workers because, you know, the competition, Japanese cars, sales, blah, blah. What they didn't tell you is that when they close the factories here, they open them in third world countries where they can pay workers 75 cents or a dollar an hour rather than 16 or $17 an hour with benefits, whatever else, even more. And so that's the function of much of U.S. policy, is to keep these countries as client states with either showcase democracies that don't really do much for the common people or dictatorships and military control and that depress labor and allow for very wide margins of profit.
Back to the idea of the more specifically to the New World Order, what's being done to market this concept to the people? Is there a concentrated effort to sell this idea not only to the Americans but to the rest of the world?
Well, not that much. Bush occasionally brings it up. It's such a bogus concept that he's actually been kind of peddled it rather lightly, but he's brought it up occasionally. And what he means by the New World Order is this glossy promo of democracy, freedom, free markets everywhere. Combining free markets with democracy is the biggest joke. I mean, I can name about 50 countries that have free markets and have the worst tyrannies that ever walked the face of the earth, including places like Guatemala, El Salvador, Indonesia, Zaire. You want free markets, you got them there, and you got starvation wages. And free markets are good for people who have money. It means freedom for people who have money. But the gloss is that's what the New World Order is, the end of tyranny. America is supporting democracy and so forth. In fact, the U.S. has overthrown a number of democracies or has stood by while democracies are overthrown. The most recently, Haiti was a good example, where you had a democratically elected president who was overthrown by military leaders who themselves had been trained in U.S. military schools. I cannot believe that they would have done that if they didn't get a wink and a nod from somebody in the national security state. And nothing was done. You didn't see Bush calling for an international force to go down to Haiti. It wouldn't have taken much. You can take a division of Venezuelans and Brazilians. The Venezuelan president wanted to do it. Go in there and get rid of that murderous military and restore democratic civilian rule. But he can go in and preserve Kuwaiti monarchy a Kuwaiti monarchy that's been known to suppress democratic councils and throw any dissenters into jail. So the interest isn't in democracy, it's in keeping these countries open for cheap labor and cheap access to their natural resources, mm-hmm. and not let them develop these things themselves and become competitors.
Yeah, even in your example of the Gulf War, I think people were did question the idea that that we allied ourselves with royal families and at least one dictator, President Assad of Syria.
And how about another dictator, the Fahd family of Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. or the al-Sabah family of Kuwait? They're all dictatorships. They all had secret police. They all used to round up people in the middle of the night and kill them and torture them or cut their hands off or whatever else, or just destroy the free labor unions and the like. So that's who we were allied with under the guise of bringing justice and freedom into the area.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground with Dr. Michael Parenti. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that encourages discussion of international affairs. Earlier you talked about the inconsistency in the way we treat, the two examples you had were Cuba and China, but what about that inconsistency between the way we talk about the democracy and the way we support the people you just mentioned?
Well, yes, those are the inconsistencies in the rhetoric and in the reasons and in the excuse given. Yes, you can find all sorts of inconsistencies, but the underlying interest in the action is perfectly consistent. Kuwait has oil and this is serving notice to every country in the Middle East that if they try to chart an independent course the way Saddam Hussein was trying to do, this is what they're going to get. That's notice they're trying to serve to Cuba now. It's just a matter of time, too, probably before Cuba does collapse, because it can survive without Soviet aid, or it can survive a U.S. embargo, but it cannot survive both of those together. And right now it's just about choking.
Well, what you talk about sounds so deceitful, anti-American, I guess, that people might say, well, how could that possibly be? How could U.S. foreign policy be so hypocritical and so against what we believe as Americans when we have this free country and we have a free press? And if that were really the case, then we would know about it. That would be common knowledge that that's the way we operate.
Well, first, it's not anti-American. I'm not criticizing America. I'm criticizing those who use our country, our tax dollars, our sons, and now even our daughters to go fight these wars to make the world safe for the big oil cartels and ITT and Chase Manhattan and the big banks and investors in those countries. So I'm not anti-American. I think our leaders are anti-American. They don't really pursue the interests of the country, meaning the interests of the ordinary people. They pursue the interests of a very favored and privileged stratum. And that same stratum also owns the major news networks and chain newspapers and all that, and they have a similar perspective. They're not going to criticize a worldview which makes the world safe for their class and their wealth and their investments. But it's very hard to get the American people to go out and spend billions in taxes and the blood of their children to make the world safe for Chase Manhattan Bank. So you tell them, we're doing this to stop the Soviet menace. All these things are geopolitical and strategic to stop the Soviet menace. Now the Soviet Union is dissolved, and I've always argued it wasn't the Soviet Union that was the primary threat. It was just the things I've been saying. So now that that is dissolved, now they're talking about there's a whole world of adversaries out there. You never know who might come next and all that. And through their control of the media, they demonize a particular leader. And in the absence of any counter-information of equal currency, the people will believe it. I mean, it's very hard not to. But it is rather extraordinary to know that a Saddam Hussein, whom the CIA was helping a couple of years ago, can be within a year demonized, and you convince people that this small country of 18 million people is a mortal threat to the peace and security of the world and to our national security, and therefore we've got to take these drastic actions. And then people don't hear of the aftermath. They don't hear of what is the aftermath of the invasion of Grenada. Unemployment is higher than ever. Hunger is back. What's the aftermath of the invasion of Panama? What's the aftermath of a right-wing electoral victory in Nicaragua after you've battered and beaten the people for 4 months? You have 50% unemployment now with the free market reforms. You have something like 79% of the people living below the poverty level. And all. You don't hear about that stuff. All you hear about, the Sandinistas were bad, Noriega was bad, Saddam Hussein's a demon. And by demonizing the leader, you, and then associating the leader with the country, you can attack the country.
So it's not... the American people aren't necessarily stupid, and they can't read the writing on the wall here. It's just that they don't have the right information, haven't heard the right arguments.
I think that's quite true. They don't. They may occasionally get a little hint that there are death squads in El Salvador or something, but what they don't know is that those death squads are financed by U.S. tax dollars, and they don't know why that happens. Even the liberal criticisms that are usually made are usually that U.S. policy is irrational or foolish, and we're backing the wrong people, and why do we always end up backing the wrong people? Those aren't the wrong people. Depending on whose interests are involved, those are the right people. If you're one of the Fortune 500.
Well, you mentioned the Cold War and the dissolution of the Soviet Union there earlier. I had a couple of questions to ask you about the Cold War. What was the significance of the Cold War for the American people and for America's role in the world?
Well, it got them attuned to the idea that the world was made up of demonized enemies who might want to come and threaten us and invade us at any moment, and it got them attuned to the idea of having an immense, enormous, incredibly costly military establishment of $300 billion a year, while their bridges are falling apart, the schools are falling apart, the public hospitals are closing, and all those sorts of things, and we're having a recession and people getting laid off because there aren't any funds. So it got them attuned to this garrison state that we have. And whether or not the U.S. leaders, global interventionist leaders that we have, will be able to continue to convince them that the most important thing is for them to make these kinds of sacrifices, because Dick Cheney imagines that there may be a whole world of adversaries out there who might get us. I mean, why doesn't Sweden feel so threatened? Why are these guys all want to get us? Why doesn't Spain have a global network of bases all over the world because someone's going to get them? Who are we protecting? What exactly are we protecting, and who are we protecting the people from? I say we're protecting them from social change in these countries, but social change is the very thing that these countries need. Whatever else you want to say about the Sandinistas, when they came into power, they started an educational program, public health clinics. For the first time in their history, the Nicaraguan people had public health clinics. They did land reform. They took about half the country was owned by 35,000 Nicaraguans, and they took half of the arable land away, and they gave it to people who didn't have land, including city lots and for housing. For people who are living in hovels. They did things like that. It's that kind of thing. When you start doing things like that, that's when you incur the ire of the U.S. Corporate and political leadership.
Earlier, Dr. Parente seemed to say that the former Soviets were the champions of liberation around the world, while the United States was the oppressor. I asked him if that's what he really meant to say.
Now, champions might be too strong a word, but the Soviet Union, for whatever their reasons, did give aid. You ask Nelson Mandela, and he says the Soviet Union were the only people who helped us, while the United States was supporting an apartheid regime, while the CIA was feeding information to the South African police, which led to the arrest and incarceration of Nelson Mandela for so many years. The Soviets were giving aid to the ANC. And they gave aid to the Cubans, and the Cubans in turn gave aid to a number of national liberation movements. Now all that aid is going to be abolished. I don't necessarily say they're the champions of freedom, but they were, as communists, more inclined to be closer to the forces of social change in those countries, to the oppressed, than they were to the multinational corporations and big rich investors who came into those countries. Now, of course, all that has changed, and the Most of the leadership, Moscow intellectuals and all that are totally, madly in love with the country that has no problems, with the country that where everything is so beautiful and wonderful, that's the United States, and they want to, as quickly as possible, become like the U.S. You can't, if you ever talk to them, you can't convince them that we have problems here. Or if we do, they say, yes, you have problems, but you're solving them. Yours is a wonderful country.
What happens now? I mean, once there's no more a big enemy out there who's causing this social change, who we can blame it on, who we can use as sort of our interchangeable enemy in all these different places around the world, now that that's gone, Don't we face sort of a crisis now that there's no more interchangeable red menace?
The next target will be the center. Once the left is shattered or dissolved, the next target is the center, which people on the center don't ever realize, that the only backbone the center ever had was the left. It was people on the left who were the first out in the peace demonstrations. It was people on the left who were the first out in the civil rights movement, and the anti-war movement, and the solidarity work for third world countries and all that. Once they are successfully contained or shattered, then they go to work on the liberals in Congress and begin to box them in, which isn't very hard to do because those liberals are really wimped out. They're constantly concerned about their respectability and their credibility, whereas the right-wing Republicans aren't afraid of anything. Look at the confirmation hearings for Clarence Thomas for the Supreme Court. The liberal Democrats were constantly worrying about being respectable and not being too excessive, and the Republicans went out there and bashed and slashed and defamed Anita Hill without the slightest compunction that they were not playing fair. And when Senator Leahy was asked about this, why didn't you answer their abuse and their character assassinations, he said, I would not stoop to that kind of actions. But no one's asking him to indulge in it. We're asking him to answer the kinds of charges and answer those tactics and challenge those tactics, not to indulge in those tactics. And that's something the Democrats haven't done. It's their turn now, and it's going to be a pretty ugly fight. Don't think for a moment, because the right-wing corporate capitalist forces are triumphant everywhere, that they're satisfied. They will now be the eco-terrorists, who they call, that is, people who support and defend the environment. They will be targeted, and there will be any number of other liberals, the American Civil Liberties Union, and all these other groups. The goal, really, is finally to undo democracy. The best way you can make capitalism safe is to get rid of popular forces that challenge the privileges of the financial powers that be.
That is Dr. Michael Parenti. I'm Keith Porter. To order a cassette of this Common Ground interview with Michael Parenti, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for program number 9217. That's program number 9217. Cassettes cost $7.95 plus shipping and handling. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation, or you have some comment about the program, you can write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, the phone number to call to order cassettes is 1-800-767-1929. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.